Good afternoon. My name is Sarah, and I'll be the conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the What You Need to Know If Collective Bargaining Comes to Virginia. Today's audio conference is hosted by the Virginia Municipal League and presented by the Williams Mullen Law Firm. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, press star, the number one on your telephone keypad. If you'd like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. At this time, I would like to introduce our speaker, Jim Meese. Jim is Vice Chairman of the Williams Mullen Board of Directors and former Chair of the Williams Mullen Labor and Employment Practice. In practice for nearly 30 years, Mr. Meese possesses extensive experience representing businesses throughout the U.S. and internationally in all areas of labor and employment law. A primary concentration of his practice is assisting clients in maintaining their non-union status. Mr. Meese has nearly 30 years of traditional labor law experience involving all types of employment and labor matters. He is joined by his colleague, Nelson Wilkinson. Mr. Meese, you may begin your conference.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon to everybody. We have a very nice turnout. First of all, I'd really like to thank Mike Amix of the Virginia Municipal League and Jim Campbell of the Virginia Association of Counties for getting us together today as we have worked through this very important pending topic of unionization in the public sector. We do not have, as you can see, a PowerPoint. We believe that it was just better for us to impart information that Nelson and I have on this topic. We are thoroughly versed in it. We have represented both public and private employers in this area. We've written on the topic extensively. So if after the call is over, anybody wants to contact us and talk to us about this topic in more detail or any more specifics, or really our thoughts on it as it is an evolving situation, as you will hear, please feel free to do so. This issue of public safety officials, collective bargaining, and these bills specifically have been around for quite a while. They're sponsored mainly, they started being sponsored by the Firefighters Union. And they're, as opposed to the private sector bills for changes in labor law that many of you are familiar with, the EFCA Act and the Card Check Act, as it's called, they don't seem to get the publicity, and they don't seem to raise the verve and the ire, quite frankly, of the public. Nelson and I think that's really because of the governmental process, and it's because the people running for office many times in more local elections really want the endorsement of police and fire, obviously, and many times these people want them to endorse these public safety collective bargaining bills, and they do so. So that's why we've seen that these bills have really gotten bipartisan support where the private sector bills have not. These bills that are up there now, again, they've been introduced before, and they actually passed the House in 2008. They do have bipartisan support. The administration felt very strongly, perhaps prior to last night and what happened in Massachusetts, that they were going to be able to get these bills through the first part of the year. That remains to be seen now, but early reports from our contacts up in our D.C. office are saying that they really don't see much of a change to this particular these particular bills as far as support. That remains obviously to be seen. One of the things that got my attention early on was I did a seminar with my colleague who's been the lobbyist for the National League of Cities for a long time, and I've known him in D.C. for a long time, and he predicted very strongly a couple of months ago that that these bills were definitely going to pass. We were asked to get involved in this by, as I said, Mike Amix and Jim Campbell, and to try to educate as many people as we can around the Commonwealth. We've been doing that. We've been having some seminars for various groups in various locations. And I must say, whether it's attorneys in the public sector or elected officials or HR directors or whatever, there is a surprising lack of knowledge about these bills and about what they would do to the landscape in Virginia. Some of you who are on the call now, I would imagine you have operated in states that have public sector collective bargaining in their localities. You probably know how fundamentally different those states and those localities operate as opposed to the Commonwealth of Virginia. I would submit to you that having public employees unionized has proven to be to cause a fundamental change in the culture of government institutions in general, and it has also served to fundamentally change the business climate within a state. Our goal today is to review these bills briefly, to talk with you about how passage of these bills as drafted would affect local governments, the procedures that would be put into place determine whether or not your employees would be unionized and whether or not you would have to bargain collectively with them over all terms and conditions of employment. And then finally, to answer your questions and talk about any next steps or strategies, if necessary, that you may need to think about to prepare for this. So with that introduction, I am going to turn it over to Nelson to just give a brief overview of sort of how we got here in the Commonwealth and what the state of our law is now.
I'd like to just first echo what Jim said and welcome you all here today. Thank you for your interest in the topic. As Jim alluded to, this is something that whether or not it passes in the short term, it's an issue that's not going to go away. The police and fire unions and groups in other states have been long fighting for this or similar bills, and it consistently comes up year after year, and it's not likely to stop. The current law in Virginia, as most of you are probably aware, is that the state cannot recognize unions of public sector employees. What that means is, of course, the public employees are welcome to form unions. That right's protected by the Constitution. However, the state cannot recognize them for purposes of public sector bargaining. What that means in practice is that these unions of public employees are not what you traditionally think of as a union, a group formed for the purposes of collective bargaining, but they're rather more lobbying arms. And the chief goal of that lobbying, of course, is to get collective bargaining rights in the state. It became code in Virginia in 1993. That is a law signed by Governor Wilder, and that made it official that the state could not bargain with the public sector unions. Now, before that, it had been a matter of precedent. It was sort of a controversial issue whether or not, because of Dillon Rule and some other things, whether these unions were recognized. There were periods when they were, there were periods when they weren't. But in 1993, again, a generally bipartisan law signed by Governor Wilder made it official that the Commonwealth would be non-union in regards to state employees. In fact, it's worked well in Virginia. A recent Pew study found it to be the best-managed state, and a major component of that was a leader in human resources management. So Virginia's had great success with the administration of its employees, human resources, and so forth. And a large part of that we think is because of the 1993 law keeping unions out of it. Now, what the Public Safety Employer-Employee Cooperation Act, as the bills are called, would do is preempt the Virginia law, or effectively preempt it, in regards to police, ambulance drivers, and fire employees, what they're called public safety employees. Now, as we'll discuss later, the scope of who is and isn't a public safety employee is not as clearly delineated as it could be. However, it's fairly clear that at least fire, ambulance, and police employees would be allowed to form unions that would then have to be recognized by the state as an employer. So that's the basic outline of the current Virginia law and the effect that the statute would have on it. As a procedural matter, what would happen upon the bill's passage is that an existing federal agency called the Federal Labor Relations Authority, what the Federal Labor Relations Authority is, if you're familiar with the National Labor Relations Board, it's the, in essence, the federal version of that. It fills the same role for federal employees that the National Labor Relations Board fills for private employees. Upon passage of the act, they would have to review within 180 days every state's laws and ensure that those states' laws met with five specific requirements. First, to allow public safety employees to form labor unions. As I mentioned, Virginia is currently technically in compliance with that first component. Second, it would have to require state employees to recognize the unions, which Virginia is not in compliance with. It would require employers to bargain with the union. It would require employers to provide for arbitration or mediation of union disputes, and would have to provide court remedies for union rights. Now, the Virginia law does not comply with the latter four in regards to public safety employees. It would have 2 years after the authority flunked it, if you will, to get its laws in compliance. And if it did not, the unions for the state of Virginia, public and public safety employees, as well as for every other state that had not previously recognized those rights, would come under the authority of the Federal Labor Relations Authority, which means that it would have control over the rulemaking with regards to these unions, investigation of complaints, adjudication. Basically, every aspect that the National Labor Relations Board has in the private sector. And as Jim's going to talk about, I think, a little bit later, that will, of course, have a profound effect on the state's relationship with its fire and police, firemen, policemen, and ambulance drivers.
One thing I'd like to mention, I find it really curious that the drafters of the bill put the words cooperation in the act. I would submit to you that if you ask your colleagues in the Northeast and the Midwest who have to deal with these myriad of public sector labor unions all the time, I doubt that they would concur with the fact that there's a lot of cooperation that goes on. And that said, I will tell you that in the past 6 or 7 months of speaking to groups within the Commonwealth, I have been surprised with what Nelson mentioned, and that's how many of our local government managers are having to deal with entities who regularly say to them that I have talked to my union. I understand what you're asking me to do, but I'm going to go run that by my union. So it was very apparent to me, as Nelson said, that there are people who are actively in labor unions right now, which I think is instructive and important for us when we realize how unions are formed. Once you have flunked as Virginia and many other states in the Southeast would, and quite frankly, most right-to-work states will flunk. It is very interesting as to sort of what happens next. Before I get into that, though, I want to say, Nelson mentioned to you that the Commonwealth of Virginia ranks number one by the one of the Pew Research folks as to how well they manage their people. You should know that the very agency that is going to determine whether we flunk and is ready to come in 2 years and take over our process of managing our people, the Federal Service Labor Management Relations Authority, by the same Pew Research folks who rate government agencies, ranks dead last, has ranked dead last as far as efficiency goes, for a number of years. So I think you could tell that the bar would really have nowhere to go but down in the Commonwealth of Virginia if this were to happen. Well, if the acts pass, what happens then is it kicks into just pretty much what the private sector goes through, and that is whether 30% or more of the employees in the unit, keep that name in mind, the bargaining unit, which is not defined by the law, have signed up and that they want to join a union. Back to my earlier comment, it seems to me like a number of people in the Commonwealth of Virginia have signed up already and said they want to belong to a union. And then the question is whether or not the public entity would voluntarily recognize that union or whether they would ask to hold a secret ballot election to where the employees would vote after a certain period of time as to whether they wanted to be represented or not. I think those of you on the phone can fully understand, and I can tell you that we've had much talk with folks out in the field, that there would be tremendous pressure on many of our cities and counties in certain areas of the Commonwealth to go ahead and capitulate and to voluntarily recognize these unions and not have any kind of an election. It correspondingly is probably true that there would be some government bodies who would say, yes, go ahead and have an election. The dilemma there is, as the question is then presented, unlike the private sector, is would the entity then spend money on legal help and whatever to campaign with its employees to keep them from joining a union? That could get politically, let's say, interesting, and it would put some pressure probably on the constituents of some of our elected folks, and the issue would no doubt be raised as to whether that was an adequate expenditure of taxpayers' money to do that when indeed there would be taxpayers in that entity who would no doubt not believe that the entity should do anything other than voluntarily recognize the union. Once the union is either certified by election or whether it is voluntarily recognized, the employer then, the public entity, has a duty to begin collective bargaining over all terms and conditions of employment with that bargaining unit. That is something that Nelson and I tell everyone is very troubling, in that who is in the bargaining unit is extremely important, and there's no guidance given under this act. So that is going to be left to be figured out by the authority. Unfortunately, if the models around the country for this, in police and fire, many of the supervisory people, positions, if you will, are included in these units all the way up to the captain level, and anybody who has had any experience in this would know that that is a very, very difficult situation to be in, to have supervisors all the way up to that level who are what you would think clearly members of supervision and perhaps even management in the labor union. So there would be a unit determination, there would be a there would be a demand to bargain, there would be collective bargaining starting from scratch. That's what the entity would think. I've had a lot of people tell me, well, you just start from nothing, don't you? And the answer is that is not practical. Your employees would take everything, that every benefit and wage that they have right now, and think that they've got that in their pocket, and the only thing they're going to want is more. And that is pretty well proven true in other states. There are some in the public sector, some deviations from the process, the way it works there, in that if you come to an impasse in negotiations, which many times you do, there is a prohibition that public sector employees can't strike. Well, I think a number of you on the telephone probably can point to numbers of strikes that you've heard about in states of in the northern tier yearly. Teachers strike, sanitation workers strike, transit workers strike. Most all of these states have provisions that their public employees cannot strike. So you can take that for what it's worth. Some of the issues actually are limited as far as collective bargaining goes. For example, police can't bargain over the use of force and things of that nature. Unfair labor practices, if the entity is accused of committing unfair labor practices along the way, those will be handled under the federal authority as well. One of the big problems in the public sector, and something that many of us question the constitutionality of, is once you get to impasse where the sides have no more to say and the entity has said, we're only going to give you this much wage increase, or a more likely example, most of these unions are going to want to get out of the Virginia retirement system, and they're going to want to have the firefighters' pension plan or the police pension plan. Let's say that's an impasse issue. If they can't strike, then there's got to be some way to resolve that situation. The bills call for interest arbitration of that. Interest arbitration, quite in short, is a third-party arbitrator comes in at that point in time and listens to both sides and goes away and in his or her wisdom determines what the right answer is and provides the public entity with an appropriate collective bargaining agreement. And you can imagine how that goes. If that requires a tax increase, then so be it. This is a binding arbitration by a third party. That is a very serious provision in this bill, to say the least. It takes away the bargaining rights from the parties. In my view, having seen it, it discourages true collective bargaining. It encourages a party to hold fast to a very hard position, knowing that there's going to be some compromise generally in their favor, I would say, once the arbitrator comes in. So that's the short version of sort of what happens after this takes place. I would just say one more thing, and Nelson talked about the 2 years that you get to get your act together before the authority comes in. Again, many of us have opined, since their union's waiting in the wings already and since our employees are already signed up, I think it's a fair observation to say that many public entities are going to be confronted at probably public address agendas in their Board of Supervisor meetings or City Council meetings, where somebody's going to come forward from the police department pretty quickly and present them with a petition saying we've signed up 95 or 100% of our people and we want to be recognized. So that's going to create some tension as to how that's handled. Nelson's going to take our next segment.
One point I should have mentioned earlier, you know, when giving these talks, one question we frequently get asked is, well, is my county exempt from the act? You know, maybe I only have 50 employees, you know, 10,000-person county. There is an exception in the act that does not extend its coverage to very, very small counties. But the line is 5,000, a population of 5,000 or less, or less than 25 full-time employees. So only very small counties or municipalities would be exempt. Jim also mentioned the prohibition on strikes. And in most states that do currently permit public safety or public sector bargaining, as you mentioned, they do have these prohibitions on strikes. However, as you mentioned, they're not always effective. In fact, New York has one of the strictest laws against public sector strikes. Very, very strict, black letter law. Yet that law was in place when the New York transit strike a few years ago took place. So it's no guarantee that these won't happen. Historically, there have been police strikes. There have been fire strikes. And predictably, the results have been disastrous. I mean, it doesn't take much imagination to, conceive of what would happen if you know there's going to be no policemen out there. So it is a concern. However, as Jim also mentioned, the interest arbitration is more common resolution than the strike. But it's a very, very significant aspect of the bill that it imposes this interest arbitration. If it sounds familiar to a lot of you, it's because interest arbitration was also a significant part of the Employee Free Choice Act, and one that many people in our line of work think is, including myself, think is just as significant as the card check provisions of the act. So for all the reasons Jim mentioned, interest arbitration is profound effects on bargaining, if you can even really call it our bargaining if someone else is deciding it for you. But beyond those, the strikes and the interest arbitration and a lot of these problems that arise in any kind of bargaining context, there are a number of issues that are unique to the public sector. As I believe Jim mentioned, public sector employees are far, far more likely than private sector employees to join these unions. I think it's about 7 or 8% of private employees belong to unions, whereas we have about almost 40% of public sectors. The first of these issues, as you mentioned, was the striking. Another is just issues of democracy. For example, once the state has to bargain with the public sector employees, it takes certain issues that would otherwise be the province of the elected officials who are responsible to the voters. It would take those issues outside of the hands of the voters and put them into these sort of backroom bargaining sessions or even interest arbitration rather than being responsible to the public. Take, for example, if your county might have volunteer crossing guards. The county may have decided to go with volunteer crossing guards rather than police crossing guards because it saves money. Maybe it creates some jobs for some people. But whatever the reason, that issue is in the hands of the voters. Well, if the public police unions come in, they say, well, hold on, that's a term and condition of employment. We want to have our people doing this job. There's precedent out there that they would have to bargain over that. The state would have to reach an agreement with them rather than with the voters. Another example that Jim raised was the use of deadly force. Now, it's correct, as Jim said, that many states that have police unions, they prohibit them from bargaining over the use of deadly force. The reason they would bargain over the use of deadly force is because that's technically a term and condition of employment. You know, a policeman can be disciplined for using excessive force. You know, if a policeman is disciplined for that, then it has to go through the union arbitration, et cetera, unless it's taken out of the bargaining. It's not actually true in every state that that's taken off the bargaining. And, in fact, I think Connecticut has had, a few years ago, had serious problems with, you know, alleged police brutality and several other incidents, which resulted in them eventually taking it off. Now, nothing in the bills that are currently, as they're currently written, would require the states to remove that from collective bargaining. Likely it's an issue that just it's a kind of detailed issue that hasn't reached the lawmakers' attention. But those kinds of issues would also ultimately be left up to the authority. Whether or not they would want to put it in bargaining is anyone's guess. But if they're, you know, if the past is any indication, if their treatment of federal employees is any indication, they'll want to leave as much to bargaining as they possibly can. So it's a real issue, and again, these are issues that are unique to public employees, and it really is at the intersection of, the democratic processes.
One of the other things that comes up frequently, and many of you on the call, I didn't get a chance to peruse where you're from, but volunteer firemen, fire departments is something that's near and dear to many of our hearts here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and obviously that is an issue and a bargained issue, very hotly bargained issue for firefighters if they have the ability to bargain over all terms and conditions of employment. I'm going to just wrap up here. I was going through our notes. I think we've really covered just about all of the text here. One of the things that comes up in virtually every time we speak to anybody about this, no matter whether it's public or private sector people, is they'll say, well, aren't we really in pretty good shape because Virginia's a right-to-work state? That comes from just a fundamental misunderstanding that a lot of people have on what right to work means, and I always want to clear that up at some point. Many of you may absolutely know what it means, but a lot of people impart more to it than it really means. It's extremely important, there's no doubt about it, but all it means is that a clause in a contract, which is called a union security clause, that you can see in any contract in a non-right-to-work state that says that you have to be a member in good standing of the union within 90 days of your employment or you get terminated, that clause is void, that you cannot, as a condition of employment, require compulsory unionism in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And that's what it means. It doesn't mean that you can't strike. It doesn't mean that you can't have unions in the public sector. It doesn't mean that you can't have dues check off out of your paycheck. It doesn't mean any of those things. And a lot of people just kind of broadly interpret that. As Nelson said, presently we have a statute that forbids contracts, collective bargaining agreements between government entities and public sector employees. We have that. And then we also have the right to work law, which states that there cannot be compulsory unionism as a term and condition of employment. So with that, I will open it up to questions. Is the operator still on?
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star and then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We will pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Andrea Haley. Your line is now open.
Law enforcement officers, including Sheriff Taylor.
Yes, this is Andrea Haley in Danville. You talked a lot about police and fire, but can you provide some guidance on corrections and sheriff's offices as well? If I understand they're covered under the bill?
Well, your understanding is probably correct. That is an area that is another one of these gray areas. Everywhere we go, we are asked by corrections, animal control officers. The latest one we had, I'm sorry, was your name Andrea?
Yes.
Andrea, the latest one we had, Andrea, were the wastewater treatment operators who wanted to understand that they could be in a union because they felt like they were also guarding the public because of, you know, the water systems and homeland security and whatever. So I can't really give you but so much guidance except telling you that typically in the states, there are a couple states that have kind of gone this way that are instructive. One is Missouri. There's massive litigation out there. It is just, I can't imagine the money that they must be spending in a time when the fiscal crisis is so bad for localities. But, you know, unfortunately, everybody wants in.
Well, the bill does reference the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968 using that definition of law enforcement officer. Are you familiar with that?
We are familiar. We're familiar with the designation. I'm not going to tell you I'm familiar with the designations within that act.
Okay. Thank you.
I can tell you, as I said, we wrote, it didn't make it out your way, I don't think, but it didn't make it the wrong times, but we wrote an op-ed piece on this a couple of weeks ago, and the calls that my assistant fended from people calling in saying, identifying themselves as public employees and basically asking if we could represent them to get in a union. Obviously, they really didn't read the article very well, but it was pretty astounding.
Yeah, I'd just add that I think that, I mean, I think you are correct that correctional officers would fall under it, but there will be lots and lots of issues at the margins that are just not settled by the text of the bill. And one of the frightening things about it is all those are going to be settled by the authority. It's just going to be an incredible, you know, it's going to be an unprecedented amount of power to that agency, which is presently just confined to federal employees. So they're going to have a lot of authority to, you know, make these sort of interpretive decisions.
And we also know one other point on that, that the state, we're very close with the State Department of Human Resources here, and they report that there's a, you know, very high degree of organization among the state correctional officers.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from Michelle Heyer. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Michelle. I'm calling from a small town in Edinburgh, Virginia. And what my question is Nelson was touching on exemptions for small counties or small entities.
Yes.
Can you verify that you did say that an entity would be exempt if they had less than 25 full-time employees?
That's correct. Less than 25.
Okay, because our little town, we only have 9 full-time employees, so we would be totally exempt from this?
You would, as it's currently written. You know, every year that they bring these things back up, those sorts of things change. But, yes, under if the current language passed, you would be exempt.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go on a hiring spree, Michelle.
Your next question comes from Doug Goodman. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the information, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Doug.
We got a question. I'm going to dovetail on Michelle's question. Is that 25 full-time employees for the entire entity or 25 in the agency, the individual agency? Like if I have 24 full-time sworn law enforcement officers, yet the town has 69 employees, can you break that down for me?
Yeah, the way it's written, it's the town's employees.
Right.
Not police or fire or public safety employees. It's the town's employees, again, or the population of 5,000.
Okay, thank you very much. That noise you heard was the wind going out of my sails. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There are no further questions at this time.
Okay. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. We hope that you found the program interesting and informative. Once again, I want to thank the Virginia Municipal League, the Virginia Association of Counties. You have our contact information on the screen. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to call either one of us. If there are no further questions at this time, this will conclude the conference call. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.